What is the perfect story? Does it exist? Is there a tangible formula? Has the perfect story ever been told? And if so, are we simply trying to retell this story over and over? This podcast is called The Midnight Myth, and somewhere between the black of night and the break of dawn, there is a story, and it's perfect. My name is Derek Jones.
And my name is Laurel Hostack.
Welcome to The Midnight Myth. Welcome back to The Midnight Myth, everybody's favorite history, mythology, philosophy, and how those subjects bubble up into our popular storytelling podcast. As always, I am very excited to be back with another episode of The Midnight Myth. Hope everybody is doing well. I know a lot of you are clamoring for our third part to our Wes Anderson series. That is not this episode. We decided to do a bonus Midnight Myth meditation. We had just finished watching the HBO series Succession, and it was a very popular series. A lot of people were talking about it. Point of fact, Laurel and I had zero intention of even watching this show. It didn't really seem like something that would be akin to our interest. I don't really care about billionaires fighting for their father's empire at all. Then everybody was saying you have to see Succession. So we decided we'd take a plunge into it. And boy, it kind of took over our life and we did nothing but watch Succession. It's over and we really wanted to talk about the show. We had some things that we wanted to pick apart, but we figured we wanted to keep the format loose. So we're going to do a meditation on HBO's hit series Succession. Spoiler wall is up. If you haven't seen Succession, we're going to talk about all four seasons, so please see it, because no subject will be withheld in terms of plot synopsis or dialogue around what actually happens. But I'm really stoked to do this.
Yeah, me too, to give you guys listeners a sense of the pace at which we consumed Succession and the sort of passion that it gripped us with. We started watching it right around the time that I want to say like the third or fourth episode of the final season was airing. And we ended up watching the final episode maybe 2 weeks after it aired. So we are parents and we have 1 to 2 hours of uninterrupted TV time per good day if the Phillies aren't playing. So that is saying a lot. We plunged way into this and we just slurped it up really, really quickly. So we hope you enjoyed it. We obviously deeply loved it and can't wait to talk about it. I think there are tons of parallels to history, mythology, and philosophy. But again, we're approaching this as one of our meditation episodes. So it's a little bit of a looser structure. It is a little bit more of us reacting in the moment than a fully researched episode. But I want to look at it as a jumping off point for so many of the questions that came up as we were watching the show.
Wonderful. I can't wait to talk about it. I absolutely adored the show. But before we roll up our sleeves and we get too deep into it, Laurel, do your thing.
Hey, follow us on social media. We're on Twitter at The Midnight Myth. We're on Instagram at Midnight Myth Podcast. And we're on Facebook. We're also on the World Wide Web at midnightmyth.com, where you can find lots more content and information about us and our two spinoff shows, The Wheel of Ka and Sleep and Sorcery. Wheel of Ka just recently hit the feeds. Notice I said feeds, two of them. The Midnight Myth feed as a bonus, and then its own new special shiny feed for the Wheel of Ka, with the first episode on part one of The Talisman. So if you were reading along with Derek and Steve, or you are a Stephen King fan, or you just like listening to them and have no idea what they're talking about, check it out wherever you like. And definitely make sure you subscribe to the Wheel of Ka feed on its own so you can get all that content in one index. Meanwhile, Sleep and Sorcery is back for season 3. I can't believe it's already season 3 of Sleep and Sorcery. And we are off to the races. It's been super fun to create new content for that. So if you're looking for a way to drift off to sleep to magical fantasy settings, that is the place to go. Anywhere podcasts are found, YouTube and Insight Timer. Meanwhile, down in the show notes, there's a link to subscribe to our newsletter for the 3 podcasts. And that is the best place to find out what's going on with us and also get updates on my book, Sleep and Sorcery, which is coming out next year around this time. So definitely sign up for that to stay in touch with us.
Wonderful. Wow. Lots of your thing.
Ooh, lots of stuff.
Yeah, lots of your thing. We have a lot going on in life.
Yeah.
Yeah, and a lot going on with our podcasting and whatnot.
Which is maybe why we haven't finished our Wes Anderson series yet.
And yes. And plus, we just need to sometimes watch things to relax.
Yeah, and we have a 2.5-year-old.
And Succession was one of those. And then when we're done, we're like, should we podcast about this?
100%.
All right, I will do the briefest of brief recaps. I'm not going to recap 4 episodes of television. This movie, this TV show, is about a company led by the patriarch of the family.
Logan Roy.
Wow, his name just blanked. Logan Roy, who in the very first episode is ready to give the mantle to his son, Kendall. And then he has a change of heart and decides that maybe Kendall's not ruthless enough. And it starts off a crisis of succession. Logan Roy is very old. He is not very well. He has several children. Which of his children will he appoint as his successor when eventually he retires? He never ends up fully appointing any one of his siblings, but they are all jockeying for position and favor. Season 1 is about the fall of Kendall from grace in his father's eyes, as well as him becoming was in a recovery from drug addiction, getting back hooked on drugs, resulting in the death of one innocent young man. And then season 2 tends to focus on the daughter, Shiv, as she is named as the potential successor. However, as time goes on, Logan starts to doubt whether Shiv has what it takes, if she's really dedicated, or if she isn't serious enough. Then we start to see Roman, the other son, start to kind of get in favor as he proves himself to be unbelievably ruthless. All of this culminates without a clear successor in line when Logan Roy unexpectedly dies in the middle of tons of different deals and counter deals happening. It ends up with a third party buying the company and then appointing Shiv's husband as a shill CEO to run the media conglomerate. It's worth noting that this media conglomerate does news, they do vacations, they do theme parks, and they do movies. And it's very much based on the lives of Rupert Murdoch, who built Fox and the empire that is Fox. It ends with none of the kids ending up as CEO, Kendall having a near mental breakdown, Shiv end up reconciling with her husband, Tom, who was estranged, and they were starting divorce proceedings simply because she wants to be close to his new title as CEO, and Roman curiously getting a drink and smiling as if he's okay to be out. There's also another child named Cameron who ends up running for president and is kind of a joke. His wife is actually a prostitute that he just promised enough money so that she would marry him. And he kind of floats in and out of the story. All in all, this is a story about a man who built an empire, a business empire. And as he is seeing the end of his reign, the question is, who will take control? And the fight to succeed Logan Roy ends up pretty much leaving every character worse than when they started.
2 things. First of all, I think that was maybe your best recap, and I just want to like frame it and put it on the wall. It was wonderful. Second of all, you called Connor Cameron, which is the name that the character Alan Ruck plays in
Ferris Bueller's
Day Off.
Oh, so, yeah. I totally switched those names.
But it's fine.
I've been up since 5 a.m. and I'm very tired. I apologize, everyone. This is unscripted, so I make a lot of errors all the time.
Yeah, but it was truly an excellent and poetic recap of those 4 seasons of television. So well done.
All right, so hit me with some high-level thoughts. This show was, for a little while, all anybody was talking about. It was very popular. What are some of your quick reactions to Succession, Laurel?
So, like you kind of said at the beginning, I really wasn't expecting to fall in love with this show like I did. I was not in the mood in late capitalism to indulge in the lives of billionaires and their struggles and these poor little rich boy things. But somehow, based on the strength of two things in particular, almost every aspect of this show is pretty perfect. But for me, it is the writing and the acting that just come together in a perfect symphony of really nuanced and really delicate and really funny interplay. So we have the incredible performances of the Roy kids and everyone who surrounds them. Kendall, oh my goodness. Everything that they are doing, and then everything that the script is doing to, even though they are despicable, endear you to them, is really handled with such nimbleness. Like, I could not believe that at times I was feeling really sorry and really powerfully for Roman, who was put up as such a despicable and vulgar and sick character at the beginning. And by the end, I was just weeping with him. And yet it still manages to distance you from their experience and remind you that they are not, as Logan says, serious people. You know, starting here with my initial thoughts, I do feel like Roman's monologue close to the very end of the finale was the thesis of the entire show when he sat down and said, "We're nothing, we're bullshit. You're bullshit, I'm bullshit." I'm paraphrasing, but mostly he just said, "We're bullshit." And that was so existential, it was so absurd, and it was such a great headline to put on this whole series, that everything they have gone through, though meaningful and deep to them, was so petty. They sat around and decided who the president of the United States would be based on whether it would be advantageous for their perspective in a deal. These are not serious people. And so that's my take on this. It was such a beautiful confluence of writing and acting. It was such a delicate and nuanced way to present these characters and make you feel for them and yet be distanced from them. And it came out of the gate hilarious and heartbreaking.
Yeah, that's one thing I wanted to mention that you said hilarious, is that the show is also really witty and funny. And I think that is part of what makes it so much more palatable. When the show first came out and people were talking about it, I checked out the first episode. I don't remember where you were, Laurel, but we were not, one of these rare moments where we're not together and I was by myself, which almost never happens. Usually if we're not together, I'm with other people that you couldn't be with, like my old friends from high school, for example. And I put on the first episode and I just wasn't in the frame of mind to enjoy that show. One, we were living, it was the Donald Trump presidency, and seeing a bunch of spoiled, rich, entitled kids get access to wealth and privilege and power that they didn't deserve wasn't something that I could do for entertainment, because I was watching that happen in the country for real. And I decided that it wasn't for me. I told you, I'm like, yeah, the acting seemed good, but I can't watch this show. Now, when the season, coming into season four, hearing just the groundswell of support for it, I felt it was important to go, and I just wanted to see, what's everyone talking about? Why is everyone saying the show is so good? I gave it another shake, and I'm really glad that I did. I think part of what makes it work is that the show can be really humorous. I also think, similar to Game of Thrones, one, Game of Thrones is it's essentially a succession crisis. The whole show is kicked off by the king dying and no one really knowing who the true heir should be. But also with Game of Thrones, is Game of Thrones engaged, especially in the earlier seasons, in structural storytelling, meaning that there are people, there are these independent actors. They appeared to have free will, but they were trapped in a cycle. Daenerys Targaryen frequently calls it the wheel of the lords in Westeros, and how it just turns and then everybody just gets crushed beneath it. That there's this structure in place that incentivizes lords to go after each other rather than to work together to make Westeros a better society. And you can put really good people like Ned Stark into that structure, and it'll churn them up and burn them out. And similar, I felt like Succession was a very structural storytelling. There is this world of politics and money and privilege and this structure that these characters are in, regardless of their intentions, chews them up and spits them out. And they are, I think for the most part, and I'd want to get your take on this, they are worse people at the end of it, in particular Shiv and Kendall. Kendall really starts the show as a very well put together, respected business person. Yeah, he partied too much and had to go into recovery and is divorced, but he's ready to take the mantle, and everyone believes that he is a worthy successor. In the end of the show, he is crying, willing to assault his brother in the attempt to assuage a board vote so he could get control, and he loses. And he loses again and again and again. And I get the feeling that it was the structure of this world that Kendall was born into that created all of these flaws that we see in him that make it impossible for him to actually succeed his father. Similar to Shiv. Shiv starts off not part of the family business. In fact, she's part of the resistance. She is helping the other political party, that is the liberal progressive party, the Bernie Sanders-esque character, which, you know, the Waystar, you know, ATN news brand is Fox News. It is supposed to be ultra-conservative, ultra-right-wing, and she's trying to help the enemies of that. And in the end, she ends up back in a loveless marriage with a man who doesn't want her, simply so that she can stay closer to that power, which she gets this opportunity in season two to be the one to take over. She always kind of wanted Tom, her husband, to take over. She thought that would be the good play. But once she got the taste that it could be her, she was not able to see anything else but her own power. Every once in a while, she might argue for something out of principle, but underneath all of those things, they're all self-serving. And in the end, she couldn't give the company to her brother because she'd rather see her husband because she might be able to control him a little bit. And both of those kids, I feel like kids, they're adults, but the children of Logan, I feel like are way worse off at the end, despite all the money and all of the acclaim and all of that. I feel like they are lesser having gone through the succession crisis. Would you agree?
I think for the most part, yeah. I don't know that I would agree with your take that they are trapped in a wheel without free will and that they don't have a choice as to their role or their path on this. I think the show presents them time and time again with the opportunity to get out, and they never take it. Until the very end, when they're forced to take the opportunity to get out. The fact that they constantly self-sabotage and rig it so that they remain either in control or in competition for control says to me there is a ruthlessness that is part of them and that they are driving this, not that the fates are driving them towards the outcome that they end up with. I think, as far as them ending up worse people, I think there's a lot of the character's end that is written in their beginning, if that makes any sense. There is always this kind of darkness lurking in Kendall, this conniving ruthlessness lurking in Shiv, and this sort of manipulative aspect to all of them. But I think Roman might be a little bit better at the end. I think Roman grows up. Because, as I said before, he comes to the realization that they are not serious people and they have to get out of this and try to be people outside of Waystar Royko, while Kendall just completely melts down because he does not know who he is except for trying to succeed his father at this business. I think Roman is actually the only one of the Roy kids who is marginally better for the experience.
I would agree. The one thing I would say about the Roman point, which I want to get back to, The one thing I would say in rebuttal to the structural storytelling, both Shiv is out at the start and her father draws her back in. And I don't know a world in which she could grow up as Logan Roy's daughter and have him come and say, I want you to take over the company, and her to say no. I just don't think that's possible. I really don't. Because I think Logan had been playing the children off of each other so he could control them their whole lives. And that, because that is who he was. And I think that is part and parcel with the world that Logan helped build and shape and create and mold. But because he was the one who built and shaped and molded the world, his children don't get that luxury. Kendall, presumably, he does get out. He is no longer appointed the successor. He goes out. He finds this young company. He wants to fund it. He wants to do his own successful venture capitalism. Nobody will work with him. Why? Because he's a Roy, and they all hate his name. So he has this opportunity to potentially branch out, and he can't. And so I do think the show, I don't think it's fate in the respect that I don't think it's three witches or the Norns that are controlling them, and we're supposed to take that away. But I think, at least for me, and all interpretations valid here, so I'm not going to argue it dogmatically, at least for me, I read it as, let's meditate on this structure that we built that makes promoting Nazis worth millions and billions of dollars. And the people that are in that structure are just as trapped as the people that are consuming that news as all of us are. That this is the new center of power in this world that we see that in Succession and perchance in ours. In the knowledge economy, who controls the knowledge is the new Caesar. And you are able to make or break presidents based off of your quarterly profit and loss statements, rather than whether or not this person should or should not be a president. And that structure makes everyone worse. You know, like, it makes everybody a bad person. Even if you want to be a good person and you try to get out of it, you're back in. Kendall tries to break out several times and can't. You know, Roman is thoroughly trapped in it up until the end. The last scene with him ordering a drink and smiling leads me to believe that he'll no longer promote Nazis for profit. You know?
And yeah, maybe, yeah.
Which I can't say that about the other two kids.
Right.
You know, like, I can say, I think he learned his lesson that throwing, gasoline on a fire of racism and bigotry to make money is probably not the right way to go. I feel like he's learned that lesson a little bit. But I still think there's something to it, which is why I view this show as a tragedy. I view this show as the downfall of the Roy's children, as the battle of succession hollows them out and leaves them worse people, potentially Roman a little better, even though they still have all of the money and all of the fame and can literally do whatever they want for the rest of their lives. And that's why I think it's a tragic story, because I don't see these characters, though within the structure they can make choices, but they could not break free of that structure.
Yeah, I think that's really well said, and actually is a great segue to kind of what I wanted to say next. And you sort of casually mixed in or threw in a reference to three witches in your what you were just saying. So
Little Macbeth.
Yeah, so my feeling is very much that this is a Shakespearean tragedy. It is a tragedy of Shakespearean proportions. And that typically implies that there is a structure, whether it's the wheel of fortune, where you might be up one day and down the next according to fortune's whims, or the great chain of being, where there is an established hierarchy in Elizabethan thought that says God is at the top and then the angels, and then on earth it's the king and then the nobles and then the commoners and then the animals and then the plants and the rocks. And that if you try to step out of this chain, you will throw the natural world and the heavens into disarray. And it has a very deep connection to one Shakespearean tragedy in particular, but I think it has echoes of many of them and many of the conventions of them. And largely, I think this is because there's a lot of involvement from people in the theater, in the writing and producing of this show. And if there's time, I'll tell a little story about my sort of personal connection to that. But the play that I'm alluding to that it is the most connected to is King Lear, of course, which is the story of an aging king who, facing down the question of who will succeed him, decides to divide his nation, his country, his kingdom, and his power between his three daughters. But as he is figuring out how to bestow these riches upon them, he asks each of them for their favor. And his two older daughters, who are very conniving and manipulative, say that they love him more than anything in the world and they'll do anything for him. And then his favorite daughter, Cordelia, says something kind of demure. She says, "I love you according to my bond, according to what I am supposed to owe a father. I can't love you more than anything in the world, because if I had a husband, I would have to give him some love." And it's a very just rational thing that she says, and it throws him into a blind rage. Eventually, he ends up naked in the rain, going totally mad, accompanied only by a fool. And then, spoiler alert for King Lear, everybody dies. And the kingdom goes to his son-in-law, and then is shared with another person who is close with the son-in-law, who spends most of the play disguised as a fool named Tom a Bedlam. So it very much goes to the Tom Wamsgans and Greg of the story.
What?
Right? But it's very much concerned with the ideas of succession and the ruthlessness that people will conjure even against their own family members in the face of, you know, unbelievable power. And then there is this element of madness or infirmity to Lear that is completely ignored by most of the people who are vying for his position because it's not advantageous to them. So the other play, I think, that is referenced heavily by Greg and Tom is Hamlet, of course, because they very much seem like a Rosencrantz and Guildenstern pair. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern also appear in a Tom Stoppard play called Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead. There are these two minor characters from Hamlet who just show up to bring Hamlet across the sea. And Tom Stoppard wrote a very existential play about them being minor characters and being fools who populate the background but actually are very influential on the story. So just fun little Shakespearean connections there. But really, at the end of the day, regardless of its mirroring certain plots of Shakespearean tragedies, I think what we're looking at is that really interesting transitional mixture between the old world of tragedy, which says you're locked in fate and it's all determined by the gods and you cannot betray it, and the more modern humanistic Renaissance toward enlightenment ideas of we have choice, but there are structures, either supernatural, divine, or human-made, that we cannot defy without causing great chaos.
I love that very much. I think that is really well said. I've never read / seen King Lear, so yes.
It's my favorite Shakespeare play.
I definitely feel like that Tom taking over and Tom of King Lear, in particular how there's a whole subplot about, I almost said it again, Connor, I almost said Cameron, Connor's wife being a somewhat failed playwright.
Yeah, absolutely.
That there's a connection to theater. They bring that in here. And so obviously, I think Tom taking over being the son-in-law makes sense in that respect. But there's another connection I'd like to make about Tom taking over in the end as the CEO of Waystar. And that is in the influences that Roman history plays on this show. And I do think it's pretty overt. You see Roman iconography in Logan's office. It's constantly talked about him owning an empire. The term having an empire comes from the Roman emperor. And he named one of his sons Roman, which is obviously a reference to the Roman, you know, the Roman history. And as a nickname, he calls him Romulus, which, in case you don't know, the mythic founder of Rome was Romulus and his twin brother Remus, who were orphaned, were suckled by a magical she-wolf, that gave them like super strength. They formed a city called Rome. They battled each other to the death. Remus gets killed. Romulus is the first king of Rome. And that is the foundation of what would go on to be the Roman Empire. It's worth noting that most historians think that's complete and total mythology and has absolutely no basis in history. But the Romans absolutely believe that that's the founding of their civilization. But there's a few other things that I think are interesting that they definitely took time to kind of understand. And I'd like to talk about a little bit the succession crisis of the Roman Empire, if you'll permit me.
Absolutely.
So this starts with Julius Caesar. If you've ever seen The Dark Knight, there's a really good explanation by the character Harvey Dent on what a Roman dictator was and how it would work. In a period of crisis, the Senate would vote to appoint someone the office of dictator. It's a temporary office. They would put a term limit. You'll be dictator for 3 months, a year, whatever. And the dictator would have full control over Roman society to navigate through the crisis, and then after the crisis would give up their authority. Well, Julius Caesar wins a civil war against Pompey, and he gets appointed. He uses his influence and his military might to be appointed the title dictator, but for life. So he is now the Roman dictator. He is one man ruler, but officially it's still a republic. Just he's the dictator. He flirts with the idea of calling himself king, and that gets him assassinated. All of this is observed by his nephew Octavian. As Octavian gets older, he ends up coming into power, winning a civil war against Mark Antony, and then he is the sole ruler. Well, how does he consolidate his rule? He knows that if he takes the title of dictator, that's tainted now because of Caesar. The Roman people will never want a king. So he looks at a few different administrative offices and he consolidates them all into one title. So first, what does he do? He's appointed for the rest of his life an office called Tribune of Plebs, which is essentially the tribune of the people. The commoners could vote and have a tribune. The tribune could propose laws and could veto any law. So they have unilateral veto power over any law. So this gives him control over the legislative office. He can veto any law he doesn't want, and he can write any law he wants. And since he is the sole ruler, the Senate's expected to just rubber stamp everything that he writes. So, Tribune of the Plebs, office number one. Secondly, he ends up being promoted to the role of Pontiff Maximus, which is head priest. That title still exists today. The Pope actually holds that title because during the Roman Empire, popes were named pontiff once the Roman Empire converted out of paganism and into Catholicism. But he gets himself appointed the pontiff, the head priest, so he can control the laws, he can control the religion. Three, he ends up being appointed governor of Egypt. That might seem obscure. Why should he be the governor of Egypt? But if you understand how the ancient economy, in particular the ancient grain economy, worked, Egypt was the most reliable producer of grain. Whoever controlled Egypt controlled the grain. Whoever controlled the grain controlled the bread. And you may have heard that Rome was built on bread and circuses. So you control Egypt, you control the bread. And lastly, there's one other very crucial piece. You need to control the military. So he gets appointed the title Imperator, which essentially translates to Commander-in-Chief. So he becomes the Commander-in-Chief of the army. He is the top army producer. You consolidate these four offices. You hold these four offices. You never get to call yourself king. You never call yourself dictator, but nobody can challenge you. You now have supreme control over every aspect of Roman political and public life, and you rule as the emperor. There's one problem. Now, this is ingenious. To the day he died, Augustus said that he was just the first among many. The first among equals, which is the title princeps, where we get the title prince from. Fun fact. But he would have never claimed to have been the sole ruler, but rather just part of the republic. This is, of course, a veneer. This is, of course, political maneuvering, knowing that if he calls himself the king of Rome, he'll probably get executed like Caesar. And so he has to maintain the pretense that it's a republic when he himself rules public life with an iron grip. The one problem with this is you can't plan a succession plan if you do it that way. If you do it that way, if it's truly a republic, you do not get to appoint who gets to rule next. Technically, the people vote for the tribune of the plebs. So the people have a general assembly and they vote. And every Roman citizen could vote. The Senate, which is not made, which is not an elected office, you get to the Senate based upon how wealthy you are. The Senate can appoint all of the other honorifics. So how can you pretend to be a republic and have a succession plan? So Augustus never had one. This would come to plague Rome, as when one emperor would die and it's not clear who the successor should be, civil wars would erupt time and time again. Now, Augustus never officially appointed a successor. He also never had any sons. So who ends up succeeding him when he dies? His son-in-law, Tiberius. Who, considering what historical source you get, was kind of creepy and sniveling and conniving, who may have had a hand in bumping off a few other more worthy successors, and when he became a successor was a little insecure, who definitely instituted programs of torture and political persecutions against people that he thought were like, but it was his son-in-law who ends up becoming the successor, not his actual true-born son. Very similar to the way we see Tom. It is Tiberius who succeeds him in that. And now, some people have said Tiberius's mother murdered every successor that Augustus would have liked. No one but Tiberius. We don't really know. There was, people were talking about that in Rome. That conversation did happen. I tend to think she was a very powerful, influential woman in a patriarchal society. So people probably were smearing her a little bit, but
what?
Who knows?
That sounds impossible. Totally unlikely.
It's also very possible that she killed everyone so that her son could take over. So in the same similar vein, we see a emperor who is really good at putting the pretense of being a benevolent ruler, who behind the scenes is ruthless and mechanical in the way that he seizes power and control, who plays children off of each other. Augustus exiled his own daughter, and she died on an island in disgrace. He adopted one of his own sons, he adopted a son who he wanted as a successor, who also died exiled and disgraced because he did play his children off of each other. And in the end, someone that no one really would have thought the quote-unquote on-paper person should be, like Kendall, right? The quote-unquote on-paper person were a whole bunch of other people for Augustus. If you want to see a really good fictional account of it, check out I, Claudius. It's brilliant. And the crisis of succession would haunt the Roman Empire until it became one office and one office only that mattered, that you held. You would still hold all the others, but there is one office that would deem to be the paramount office you need to hold. And if you held that, you were going to win. And that one office was imperator. As Rome stopped the pretense of any veneer of republicanism and became simply a military autocracy, then whoever is proclaimed by the army and not the Senate to be the emperor, the imperator, would then be the emperor, which is why that term became synonymous with ruling the empire. And I feel like succession calling to all of these Roman symbols and all of these Roman terms and all of these Roman-ness, for lack of a better word, and having it be a crisis of succession, it just delighted me as a amateur Roman historian, and just hearing that, being like, oh my gosh, that's exactly what happened to Augustus.
I love that we call this our meditation and that it was going to be like looser and we were just going to kind of talk about the show really informally, and the meditation is, I mean, spoiler alert, like, it's what we say when we don't do any research, and yet you just pulled out, like, all of this amazing Roman history, and none of it is from notes because you are just a repository of this information. And meanwhile, I talked about Shakespeare and theater history. So I'm like, this is a full Midnight Myth episode. but that is to say,
I don't need to do any history. I did the research for Roman history. It was my degree.
Yep. And yeah. It's just there and it will never leave. Same thing with a lot of Shakespeare for me. It's like, I can't remember what I had for breakfast, but I could recite a bunch of poetry from Romeo and Juliet. Anyway, what I was going to say, though, in response to that, which was such great analysis, is that these crises of succession are such fertile grounds for storytelling, and they recur throughout history, and they have proven to be this wellspring of inspiration for contemporary pop culture, right? So you think of the War of the Roses and the anarchy that influenced Game of Thrones, A Song of Ice and Fire, and House of the Dragon, and there is the crisis of succession that occurs with Elizabeth I, who never married, and we see this in so many different cultures. It happens multiple times in Rome, I believe, and there are triumvirates that rule, and always with either the insecurity of a successor or decisions to divide rule, we get conflict. And that is such ripe inspiration for storytelling.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a reason why there are imperial dynasties in Rome, because a dynasty would die out and there would inevitably be a civil war. After the end of what's called the Judeo-Claudian dynasty, which is the dynasty founded by Augustus, there's the year of four emperors. So the army and four different groups of soldiers, legions of soldiers, proclaimed four different people emperor all in the same year. And there were four emperors, and they all went to war with each other until one was left. That was Vespasian. And then that starts the Flavian dynasty. And that's when the Colosseum was built. Anyway.
And then it happens with the church, too. It happens with schisms and with popes and anti-popes and multiple people declaring for, you know, mastery of the faith. So, yeah, just certainly so much history. And so much of this seeps into the way that we tell stories now, because we just love that conflict.
And the modern empire, as we know it, is gone. The idea that in America, hopefully, you will never see one person who rules the entire civilization and will have no checks and balances. But where you can still have empire is in the world of business. You can still build up an empire in business where you can rule over that, and you can rule over that with, as the show points out, pretty much unchecked. There are laws, there are rules, there are times when the FBI comes against the Roys, but they're able to manage and control it. They break tons of laws, ethical laws, financial laws, all the time without any consequence or regard. And so there does exist this upper echelon of imperial business people. And that is why this show is so great, because it shows us this world in a fictionalized way. And it's so repugnant. It's so against everything we as Americans come to believe, which is democracy, freedom of choice.
Meritocracy.
None of these kids are worth running this empire, you know, and their only qualification to wealth and power was what their father did. That's complete opposite of what America should be.
Yeah, it's the one place in the high halls of capitalism where this old world machine can still operate, where the idea of primogeniture can still be a factor in who takes over a capitalist empire.
You should explain what that word means.
What word?
Primogeniture.
Oh, primogeniture. Oh, the first son inheriting the land or the wealth of the family. So, like Kendall being laid out as the first son, and therefore he has a right to take over this company.
Which he's
not even the first son, but there's all of this other baggage with Connor. And yes, there is this contemporary American nobility that is formed within families like the Roys and the Pierces that operate on completely different legal and moral and human standards than the rest of us plebs.
Absolutely.
So, two things as we kind of come close to winding down. Who is your favorite character on Succession?
I mean, that's a tough thing to say. One, because I enjoyed watching all of these characters. And two, they all make me sick to my stomach.
Yep.
So it's kind of hard to have a favorite. I do think Kendall is written the most sympathetically. Kendall is the one that I think in earnest wants to run the empire, even though he's not qualified to. And his father's right about that and would not be good at it. He really does want to run it and run it well. And he has a disease of substance abuse. And he is constantly succumbing to that disease. And I think for those two reasons, he's the most sympathetic of all the characters. Because when he falls hard. And it's hard to watch. Because you feel like there is a good functional corporate executive in there somewhere, but it's buried so deep among all the BS. Like watching his birthday party was so hard to watch. Watching this character just be such a complete and total tool. So I think he's the most sympathetic. I think Roman is the most just raw entertaining because he's so crazy. He's so witty, but he is also repugnant. And then I'm also a sucker for a good old Machiavellian Shivness just constantly trying to outmaneuver everyone who's sadly just not as smart as she thinks she is. And that feels a little like Cersei Lannister-y to me.
That is so the tragedy of Shiv. She really thinks she's smarter than all of them, and she is not.
Yeah, she's not dumb.
Yeah.
But she's not as smart as she thinks she is. And, you know, that's something that, like, you know, Tywin Lannister says to Cersei, "You think I don't trust you because you're a woman. I don't trust you because you're not as smart as you think you are." You know, and I think that Tywin Cersei is very much like Logan Shiv. I think Shiv is definitely a favorite of his. He brings his daughter in and says, "I'm going to make you, it's going to be you." And then he realizes, oh, no, she can't do it. So I don't think I have a favorite. I will say I do have one bone to pick with the show.
What's that?
If I may, there's one plot thread that I felt they chose to ignore rather than address. And while it doesn't ruin the enjoyment of the show, it is my one, it's the one thing that keeps me from saying, perfect, you nailed it. And between season 3 and season 4, Kendall just ceases to be an addict. And I'm not sure how or why. They mentioned that he's a Buddhist, but he is still casually drinking in season 4. So he's clearly not in recovery. So whatever happened, it happened off screen. It wasn't really explained. And that's the one tiny little chink in what I thought was perfect writing. I had done a few seasons invested in Kendall falling apart, largely due to substance abuse. I would have liked to have seen if he resolved that, how? And if he hadn't resolved it, how is he now able to like casually drink without falling over the deep end?
Yeah, that's a good point. I did get the sense that there was a significant time elapsed between seasons 3 and 4, and they just decided that maybe there was nowhere left to go with the Kendall substance abuse storyline. But I do agree that when you do that much difficult character work off screen, it often always feels like a cop-out. So I do agree with you on that point.
I mean, they could have just said he was in recovery.
Yeah.
But they made him, he's drinking in like almost every scene in season 4, but he's no longer doing drugs. And listen, I've just had a lot of addicts in my family. That's not how that works.
Yeah. Do you want to know my favorite character?
I do.
So just purely based on what a ridiculous joy it is to watch this character, my favorite is Tom Wamsgans. I love him. He is played beautifully by Matthew McFadyen, who you would never believe if you didn't know it before, that he played Mr. Darcy and is the epitome of like suave, gothic Byronic hero.
Who's Mr. Darcy? I'm sorry, I don't know that reference.
Didn't I force you to watch Pride and Prejudice on Mother's Day this year?
No.
Yes, I did, actually.
I have no memory of this.
Okay, great. So I forced you to watch it just because I wanted you to see that Tom Wamsgans is also Mr. Darcy. He is the romantic...
We watched Pride and Prejudice, the whole movie?
Yes, you fell asleep at the end.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's probably why I don't remember.
Yeah, anyway, but the fact that he's able to conjure both of these characters in such relief, I think, is a testament to what a great actor he is. He is funny, and he is such a fool, and so ridiculous, and I also feel really, really bad for him at times, and also want to punch him in his smarmy mouth in others. And he and Greg play off each other so well. They are such an entertaining pair, and it's amazing to see the two of them work in the shadows and be these overlooked characters who end up rising to the occasion and probably, you know, inheriting the mantle to the empire. Like, eventually Greg's going to be CEO, right? Like, 10, 15 years in the future, it passes on to Greg. But yeah, so I just really enjoy Tom, and I enjoy his dynamic with Greg. I also, do you want to hear my story about my theatrical connection with Succession?
Absolutely. I'd love to hear that.
So I don't know if it's actually that great a story, but it really sparked a little light bulb in my imagination. And that's that throughout the four seasons of Succession, I was watching the credits, and we never skipped the opening credits because they were great and just really mesmerizing. We usually skip credits for shows, and we just didn't for this one. And there was a name that kept popping up in the credits as a writer and a producer that was super familiar to me, but I couldn't quite place it. And finally, in season four, I decided I was going to look it up. The name of this writer and producer is Susan Soonhee Stanton. And I was like, why is that name so familiar? And what I realized is that, as I'm talking about the involvement of theater people in this, Susan Soonhee Stanton is a playwright. And she also served as a producer on Succession. And what I remembered was that when I was interning for a theater company, when I was in college, I was a literary intern, so all I did was read plays pretty much all day and write recommendations for those plays on whether or not I thought the theater should produce them. And she, Susan Soonhee Stanton, was attending Yale School of Drama at that time, along with another playwright that I really loved named Meg Maroshnik, and they were studying under the famous playwright Paula Vogel, and they submitted a lot of their work to the theater that I was working at, and I read her plays that she was writing when she was in college, and I wrote up these glowing recommendations like, you have to produce this work. It was so brilliant and so creative and so different. I remember reading one of her adaptations of The Myth of Leda and the Swan. And so it just was like a really cool thing. The fact that I was, you know, a 19-year-old kid reading this person's college work, and then she ended up
producing Succession. Yeah,
so
that's pretty cool.
Congratulations. Hopefully my glowing reviews of your plays helped you on your journey, Susan.
I love it. Great. Let us know what you think of Succession. We obviously adored the show. I don't have anything else to say. Shall we conclude this meditation?
We shall.
Until next time.
Be kind.